Here went up from the commons. "I wonder how I ought to spend your money," Littlefinger called down to Lord Renly. The hound just managed to stay in the saddle. He jerked his mount around hard and rode back to the lists for the second pass. Jamie Lannister tossed down his broken lance and snatched up a fresh one, jesting with his squire. The hound spurred forward at a hard gallop. Lannister rode to meet him. This time, when Jamie shifted his seat, Sandor Clegane shifted with him. Both lances exploded. By the time the splinters had settled, a riderless blood bay was trotting off in search of grass, while Sir Jamie Lannister rolled in the dirt, golden and dinted. Sansa said, "I knew the hound would win." Littlefinger overheard. "If your nose is going to win the second match, speak up now, before Lord Renly plucks me clean," he called to her. Ned smiled. "A pity the imp is not here with us," Lord Renly said. "I should have won twice as much." Jamie Lannister was back on his feet, but his ornate lion helmet had been twisted around and dented in his fall, and now he could not get it off. The commons were hooting and pointing, the lords and ladies were trying to stifle their chuckles and failing, and over it all, Ned could hear King Robert laughing louder than anyone. Finally, they had to lead the Lion of Lannister off to a blacksmith, blind and stumbling. By then, Sir Gregor Clegane was in position at the head of the lists. He was huge, the biggest man that Eddard Stark had ever seen. Robert Baratheon and his brothers were all big men, as was the Hound, and back at Winterfell there was a simple-minded stable boy named Hodor, who dwarfed them all. But the knight they called the Mountain That Rides would have towered over Hodor. He was well over 7 feet tall, closer to 8, with massive shoulders and arms as thick as the trunks of small trees. His gesture seemed a pony in between his armored legs, and the lance he carried looked as small as a broom handle. Unlike his brother, Sir Gregor did not live at court. He was a solitary man who seldom left his own lands but for wars and tourneys. He had been with Lord Tywin when King's Landing fell, a new-made knight of 17 years, even then distinguished by his size and his implacable ferocity. Some said it had been Gregor who dashed the skull of the infant prince Aegon Targaryen against a wall, and whispered that afterwards he had raped the mother, the Dornish princess Elia, before putting her to the sword. These things were not said in Gregor's hearing. Ned Stark could not recall ever speaking to the man, though Gregor had ridden with them during Balon Greyjoy's rebellion, one night among thousands. He watched them with disquiet. Ned seldom put much stock in gossip, but the things said of Sir Gregor were more than ominous. He was soon to be married for the third time, and one heard dark whisperings about the deaths of his first two wives. It was said that his keep was a grim place, where servants disappeared unaccountably, and even the dogs were afraid to enter the hall. And there had been a sister, who had died young under queer circumstances, and the fire that had disfigured his brother, and the hunting accident that had killed their father. Gregor had inherited the keep, the gold, and the family estates. His younger brother, Sandor, had left the same day to take service with the Lannisters as a sworn sword, and it was said that he had never returned, not even to visit. When the Knight of Flowers made his entrance, a murmur ran through the crowd, and he heard Sansa's fervent whisper, "Oh, he's so beautiful!" Sir Loras Tyrell was slender as a reed, dressed in a suit of fabulous silver armour, polished to a blinding sheen, and filigreed with twining black vines and tiny blue forget-me-nots. The commons realized, in the same instant as Ned, that the blue of the flowers came from sapphires. A gasp went up from 1,000 throats. Across the boy's shoulders, his cloak hung heavy. It was woven of forget-me-nots, real ones, hundreds of fresh blooms sewn into a heavy woolen cape. His courser was as slim as her rider, a beautiful grey mare, built for speed. Sir Gregor's huge stallion trumpeted as he caught her scent. The boy from High Garden did something with his legs, and his horse pranced sideways, nimble as a dancer. Sansa clutched at his arm. "Father, don't let Sir Gregor hurt him," she said. Ned saw she was wearing the rose that Sir Loras had given her yesterday. Jorry had told him about that as well. "These are tawny lances," he told his daughter. "They make them to splinter on impact, so no one is hurt." Yet he remembered the dead boy in the cart, with his cloak of crescent moons, and the words were raw in his throat. Sir Gregor was having trouble controlling his horse. The stallion was screaming and pawing the ground, shaking his head. The mountain kicked at the animal savagely with an armoured boot. The horse reared and almost threw him. The Knight of Flowers saluted the king, rode to the far end of the list, and couched his lance ready. Sir Gregor brought his animal to the line, fighting with the reins, and suddenly it began. The mountain stallion broke into a hard gallop, plunging forward wildly, while the mare charged as smooth as a flow of silk. Sir Gregor wrenched his shield into position, juggling with his lance, and all the while fought to hold his unruly mount on a straight line, and suddenly Loras Tyrell was on him, placing the point of his lance just there, and in an eye-blink the mountain was falling. He was so huge that he took his horse down with him in a tangle of steel and flesh. Ned heard applause, cheers, whistles, shocked gasps, excited muttering, and over it all the rasping, raucous laughter of the hound. The Knight of Flowers reined up at the end of the list. His lance was not even broken. His sapphires winked in the sun as he raised his visor, smiling. The commons went mad for him. In the middle of the field, Sir Gregor Clegane disentangled himself and came boiling to his feet. He wrenched off his helm and slammed it down onto the ground. His face was dark with fury, and his hair fell down into his eyes. "My sword!" he shouted to his squire, and the boy ran it out to him. By then his stallion was back on his feet as well. Gregor Clegane killed the horse with a single blow of such ferocity that it half severed the animal's neck. Cheers turned to shrieks in a heartbeat. The stallion went down to its knees, screaming as it died. By then Gregor was striding down the lists towards Sir Loras Tyrell, his bloody sword clutched in his fist. "Stop him!" Ned shouted, but his words were lost in the roar. Everyone else was yelling as well, and Sansa was crying. It all happened so fast. The Knight of Flowers was shouting for his own sword as Sir Gregor knocked his squire aside and made a grab for the reins of his horse. The mare scented blood and reared. Loras Tyrell kept his seat, but barely. Sir Gregor swung his sword, a savage two-handed blow that took the boy in the chest and knocked him from his saddle. The courser dashed away in panic, as Sir Loras lay stunned in the dirt. But as Gregor lifted his sword for the killing blow, a rasping voice warned, "Leave him be!" And a steel-clad hand wrenched him away from the boy. The mountain pivoted in wordless fury, swinging his longsword in a killing arc with all his massive strength behind it, but the hound caught the blow and turned it, and for what seemed an eternity the two brothers stood hammering at each other as a dazed Loras Tyrell was helped to safety. Thrice Ned saw Sir Gregor aim savage blows at the hound's head helmet, yet not once did Sandor send a cut at his brother's unprotected face. It was the king's voice that put an end to it. The king's voice and 20 swords. John Aaron had told them that a commander needs a good battlefield voice, and Robert had proved the truth of that on the Trident. He used that voice now. "Stop this madness!" he boomed. "In the name of your king!" The hound went to one knee. Sir Gregor's blow cut air. And at last he came to his senses. He dropped his sword and glared at Robert. Surrounded by his king's guard and a dozen other knights and guardsmen. Wordlessly, he turned and strode off, shoving past Barristan Selmy. "Let him go," Robert said, and as quickly as that, it was over. "Is the hound the champion now?" Sansa asked Ned. "No," he told her. "There will be one final joust between the hound and the Knight of Flowers." But Sansa had the right of it after all. A few moments later, Sir Loras Tyrell walked back onto the field in a simple linen doublet and said to Sandor Clegane, "I owe you my life. The day is yours, sir." "I'm no sir," the hound replied, but he took the victory and the champion's purse, and for perhaps the first time in his life, the love of the commons. They cheered him as he left the lists to return to his pavilion. As Ned walked with Sansa to the archery field, Littlefinger and Lord Renly and some of the others fell in with them. "Tyrell had to know the mare was in heat," Littlefinger was saying. "I swear the boy planned the whole thing. Gregor has always favoured huge, ill-tempered stallions with more spirit than sense." The notion seemed to amuse him. It did not amuse Sir Barristan Selmy. "There is small honour in tricks," the old man said stiffly. "Small honour and 20,000 gold," Lord Renly smiled. That afternoon, a boy named Angai, an unheralded commoner from the Dornish Marches, won the archery competition, outshooting Sir Balon Swan and Jalabar Zoe at 100 paces after all the other bowmen had been eliminated at the shorter distances. Ned sent Alan to see him out and offer him a position with the hands guard, but the boy was flush with wine and victory and riches undreamed of, and he refused. The melee went on for 3 hours. Nearly 40 men took part, free riders and hedge knights, new-made squires in search of a reputation. They fought with blunted weapons in a chaos of mud and blood, small troops fighting together and then turning on each other as alliances formed and fractured, until only one man was left standing. The victor was the Red Priest, Thoros of Myr, a madman who shaved his head and fought with a flaming sword. He had won melees before. The fire sword frightened the mounts of the other riders, and nothing frightened Thoris. The final tally was 3 broken limbs, a shattered collarbone, 12 smashed fingers, 2 horses that had to be put down, and more cuts, sprains, and bruises than anyone cared to count. Ned was desperately pleased that Robert had not taken part. That night, at the feast, Eddard Stark was more hopeful than he had been in a great while. Robert was in a high good humour, the Lannisters were nowhere to be seen, and even his daughters were behaving. Jorah brought Arya down to join them, and Sansa spoke to her sister pleasantly. "The tournament was magnificent," she sighed. "You should have come. How was your dancing?" "I'm sore all over," Arya reported happily, proudly displaying a huge purple bruise on her leg. "You must be a terrible dancer," Sansa said doubtfully. Later, while Sansa was off listening to a troupe of singers perform the complex round of interwoven ballads called the Dance of the Dragons, Ned inspected the bruise himself. "I hope Pharrell is not being too hard on you," he said. Arya stood on one leg. She was getting much better at that of late. "Sirio says that every hurt is a lesson, and every lesson makes you better." Ned frowned. The man, Sirio Pharrell, had come with an excellent reputation, and his flamboyant, bravassi style was well suited to Arya's slender blade, yet still. A few days ago she had been wandering round with a swatch of black silk tied over her eyes. Sirio was teaching her to see with her ears and her nose and her skin, she told him. Before that, he had her doing spins and backflips. "Arya, are you certain you want to persist in this?" She nodded. "Tomorrow, we're going to catch cats." "Cats?" Ned sighed. "Perhaps it was a mistake to hire this bravassi. If you like, I will ask Jory to take over your lessons, or I might have a quiet word with Sir Barristan. He was the finest sword in the Seven Kingdoms in his youth. I don't want them, Arya said. I want Syria. Ned ran his fingers through his hair. Any decent master-at-arms could give Arya the rudiments of slash and parry without this nonsense of blindfolds, cartwheels, and hopping around on one leg. But he knew his youngest daughter well enough to know there was no arguing with that stubborn jut of jaw. As you wish, he said. Surely she would grow tired of this soon. Try to be careful. I will, she promised solemnly, as she hopped smoothly from a right leg to a left. Much later, after he'd taken the girls back through the city and seen them both safe in bed, Sansa with her dreams and Arya with her bruises, Ned ascended to his own chamber atop the Tower of the Hand. The day had been warm, and the room was close and stuffy. Ned went to the window and unfastened the heavy shutters to let in the cool night air. Across the great yard, he noticed the flickering glow of candlelight from Littlefinger's windows. The hour was well past midnight. Down by the river, the rebels were only now beginning to dwindle and die. He took out the dagger and studied it. Littlefinger's blade, won by Tyrion Lannister in a tawny wager. Sent to slay Bran in his sleep? Why? Why would the dwarf want Bran dead? Why would anyone want Bran dead? The dagger, Bran's fall, all of it was linked somehow to the murder of John Arryn. He could feel it in his gut, but the truth of John's death remained as clouded to him as when he had started. Lord Stannis had not returned to King's Landing for the tourney. Lysa Arryn held her silence behind the high walls of the Eyrie. The squire was dead, and Jory was still searching the whorehouses. What did he have but Robert's bastard? That the armourer's sullen apprentice was the king's son, Ned had no doubt. The Baratheon look was stamped on his face, in his jaw, his eyes, that black hair. Renly was too young to have fathered a boy of that age. Stannis, too cold and proud in his honour. Gendry had to be Robert's. Yet knowing all that, what had he learned? The king had other base-born children scattered throughout the Seven Kingdoms. He had openly acknowledged one of his bastards, a boy of Bran's age, whose mother was high-born. The lad was being fostered by Lord Renly's castellan at Storm's End. Ned remembered Robert's first child as well, a daughter, born in the Vale when Robert was scarcely more than a boy himself. A sweet little girl. The young lord of Storm's End had doted on her. He used to make daily visits to play with the babe long after he'd lost interest in the mother. Ned was often dragged along for company, whether he willed it or not. The girl would be 17 or 18 now, he realized, older than Robert had been when he fathered her. Strange thought. Cersei could not have been pleased by her lord husband's byblows, yet in the end it mattered little whether the king had one bastard or 100. Law and custom gave the base-born few rights. Gendry, the girl in the Vale, the boy at Storm's End, none of them could threaten Robert's true-born children. His musings were ended by a soft rap on his door. "A man to see you, my lord," Harbin called. "He will not give his name." "Send him in," Ned said, wondering. The visitor was a stout man in cracked, mud-caked boots and a heavy brown robe of the coarsest rough spun, his features hidden by a cowl, his hands drawn up in voluminous sleeves. "Who are you?" Ned asked. "A friend," the cowl man said in a strange, low voice. "We must speak alone, Lord Stark." Curiosity was stronger than caution. "Harwin, leave us," he commanded. Not until they were alone behind closed doors did the visitor draw back his cowl. "Lord Varys," Ned said in astonishment. "Lord Stark," Varys said politely, seating himself. "I wonder if I might trouble you for a drink." Ned filled two cups with summer wine and handed one to Varys. "I might have passed within a foot of you and never recognized you," he said, incredulous. He had never seen the eunuch dress in anything but silk and velvet and the richest damask, and this man smelled of sweat instead of lilacs. "That was my dearest hope," Vara said. "It would not do if certain people learned that we had spoken in private. The Queen watches you closely. This wine is very choice, thank you." "How did you get past my other guards?" Ned said. Porter and Kane had been posted outside the tower, and Alan on the stairs. "The Red Keep has ways known only to ghosts and spiders." Vary smiled apologetically. I will not keep you long, my lord. There are things you must know. You are the king's hand, and the king is a fool." The eunuch's cloying tones were gone. Now his voice was thin and sharp as a whip. "Your friend, I know, yet a fool, nonetheless, and doomed, unless you save him. Today was a near thing. They had hoped to kill him during the melee." For a moment Ned was speechless with shock. "Who?" Varys sipped his wine. "If I truly need to tell you that, you are a bigger fool than Robert, and I am on the wrong side." "The Lannisters?" Ned said. "The Queen? No, I will not believe that. Not even of Cersei. She asked him not to fight." "She forbade him to fight. In front of his brother, his knights, and half the court. Tell me truly, do you know any sure way to force King Robert into the melee, I ask you?" Ned had a sick feeling in his gut. The eunuch had hit upon a truth. Tell Robert Baratheon he could not, should not, or must not do a thing, and it was as good as done. Even if he'd fought, who would have dared to strike the king? Varys shrugged. "There were 40 riders in the melee. The Lannisters have many friends. Amidst all that chaos, with horses screaming and bones breaking and Thoris of Myr waving that absurd fire sword of his, who could name it murder if some chance blow failed his grace?" He went to the flagon and refilled his cup. "After the deed was done, the slayer would be beside himself with grief. I can almost hear him weeping, so sad. Yet no doubt the gracious and compassionate widow would take pity, lift the poor unfortunate to his feet, and bless him with a gentle kiss of forgiveness. Good King Joffrey would have no choice but to pardon him." The eunuch stroked his cheek. "Or perhaps Cersei would let Sir Ilion strike off his head. Less risk for the Lannisters that way, though quite an unpleasant surprise for their little friend." Ned felt his anger rise. "You knew of this plot, and you did nothing. I command whisperers, not warriors. You might have come to me earlier. Oh, yes, I confess it. And you would have rushed straight to the king, yes? And when Robert heard of his peril, what would he have done, I wonder?" Ned considered that. "He would have damned them all, and fought anyway, to show he did not fear them." Varys spread his hands. "I will make another confession, Lord Eddard. I was curious to see what you would do. Why not come to me, you ask, and I must answer, why? Because I did not trust you, my lord." "You did not trust me?" Ned was frankly astonished. "The Red Keep shelters two sorts of people, Lord Eddard," Varys said. "Those who are loyal to the realm, and those who are loyal only to themselves. Until this morning, I could not say which you might be. So I waited to see, and now I know for a certainty." He smiled, a plump, tight little smile, and for a moment his private face and public mask were one. "I begin to comprehend why the Queen fears you so much. Oh, yes, I do." "You are the one she ought to fear," Ned said.
"No, I am what I am. The King makes use of me, but it shames him. A most puissant warrior is our Robert, and such a manly man has little love for sneaks and spies and eunuchs. If a day should come when Cersei whispers, 'Kill that man,' Iliad Payne will snick off my head in a twinkling. And who will mourn poor Varys then?" North or south, they sing no songs for spiders." He reached out and touched Ned with a soft hand. "But you, Lord Stark?" "I think, no, I know. He would not kill you. Not even for his queen. And there may lie our salvation." It was all too much. For a moment Eddard Stark wanted nothing so much as to return to Winterfell, to the clean simplicity of the North, where the enemies were winter and the wildlings beyond the wall. "Surely Robert has other loyal friends," he protested. "His brothers, his wife," Varys finished, with a smile that cut. "His brothers hate the Lannisters, true enough, but hating the queen and loving the king are not quite the same thing, are they? Sir Barristan loves his honour. Grand Maester Pycelle loves his office, and Littlefinger loves Littlefinger." "The king's guard, a paper shield," the eunuch said. "Try not to look so shocked, Lord Stark. Jaime Lannister is himself a sworn brother of the White Swords, and we all know what his oath is worth. The days when men like Rhyam Redwine and Prince Aemon the Dragon Knight wore the white cloak are gone to dust and song. Of these seven, only Sir Barristan Selmy is made of the true steel, and Selmy is old. Sir Boris and Sir Merin are the Queen's creatures to the bone, and I have deep suspicions of the others. No, my lord, when the swords come out in earnest, you will be the only true friend Robert Baratheon will have." "Robert must be told," Ned said. "If what you say is true, if even a part of it is true, the king must hear it for himself." "And what proof shall we lay before him? My words against theirs? My little birds against the queen and the kingslayer? Against his brothers and the council? Against the wardens of East and West? Against all the might of Castle Rock? Pray send for Sir Ilion directly. It will save us all some time. I know where that road ends. Yet if what you say is true, they will only bide their time and make another attempt." "Oh, indeed they will," said Varys, "and sooner rather than later, I do fear. You are making the most anxious, Lord Eddard, but my little birds will be listening, and together we may be able to forestall them, you and I." He rose and pulled up his cowl, so his face was hidden once more. "Thank you for the wine. We will speak again. When you see me next at council, be certain to treat me with your accustomed contempt. You should not find that difficult." He was at the door when Ned called. "Varys." The eunuch turned back. "How did John Arryn die?"
"I wondered when you would get round to that.
Tell me." "The tears of lice, they call it. A rare and costly thing. Clear and sweet as water, and it leaves no trace. I begged Lord Arryn to use a taster. In this very room I begged him, but he would not hear of it. Only one who was less than a man would even think of such a thing, he told me." Ned had to know the rest. "Who gave him the poison?" "Some dear, sweet friend who often shared meat and mead with him, no doubt."
"Ah, but which one,
"There were many such. Lord Arryn was a kindly, trusting man." The eunuch sighed. "There was one boy. All he was, he owed John Arryn. But when the widow fled to the Eyrie with her household, he stayed in King's Landing and prospered. It always gladdens my heart to see the young rise in the world." The whip was in his voice again. Every word a stroke. "He must have caught a gallant figure in the tourney, him in his bright new armour with those crescent moons on his cloak. A pity he died so untimely, before you could talk to him." Ned felt half poisoned himself. "The squire," he said. "Sir Hugh." Wheels within wheels within wheels. Ned's head was pounding. Why? Why now?
John Aaron had been hanged for 14 years. What was he doing that they had to kill him?
Asking questions, Vary said, slipping out of the door.
Jamie. The fields outside the walls of Derry were being tilled once more. The burned crops had been ploughed under, and Sir Adam's scouts reported seeing women in the furrows pulling weeds, whilst a team of oxen broke new ground on the edge of a nearby wood. A dozen bearded men with axes stood guard over them as they worked. By the time Jamie and his column reached the castle, all of them had fled within the walls. He found Derry closed to him, just as Harrenhal had been. A chilly welcome from mine own blood. Sound the horn, he commanded. Sir Kenos of Case unslung the horn of Herrick and let it wind. As he waited for a response from the castle, Jamie eyed the banner floating brown and crimson above his cousin's barbican. Lancel had taken to quartering the Lion of Lannister with the Derry ploughman, it would seem. He saw his uncle's hand in that, as in Lancel's choice of bride. House Derry had ruled these lands since the Andals cast down the first men. No doubt Sir Kevin realized that his son would have an easier time of it if the peasants saw him as a continuation of the old line, holding these lands by right of marriage rather than royal decree. Kevin should be Tommen's hand. Harry Swift is a toad, and my sister is a fool if she thinks elsewise. The castle gates swung open slowly. My cuz will not have room to accommodate 1,000 men, Jamie told Strongbore. We'll make camp beneath the western wall. I want the perimeters ditched and staked. There are still bands of outlaws in these parts. They'd need to be mad to attack a force as strong as ours. Mad or starving? Until he had a better notion of these outlaws and their strength, Jamie was not inclined to take any risks with his defences. Ditched and staked, he said again before spurring Honor toward the gate. Sir Dermot rode beside him with the royal stag and lion, and Sir Hugo Vance with the white standard of the Kingsguard. Jamie had charged Red Ronnet with the task of delivering Willis Manderley to Maidenpool, so he would not need to look on him henceforth. Pia rode with Jamie's squires on the gelding Peck had found for her. It's like some toy castle, Jamie heard her say. She's known no home but Harrenhal, he reflected. Every castle in the realm will seem small to her, except the rock. Josmyn Peckleton was saying the same thing. You must not judge by Harrenhal. Black Harren built too big. Pia listened as solemnly as a girl of 5 being lessoned by her scepter. That's all she is. A little girl in a woman's body scarred and scared. Peck was taken with her, though. Jamie suspected that the boy had never known a woman, and Pia was still pretty enough so long as she kept her mouth closed. There's no harm in him bedding her, I suppose, so long as she's willing. One of the mountain's men had tried to rape the girl at Harrenhal, and had seemed honestly perplexed when Jamie commanded Illyn Payne to take his head off. I had her before 100 times, he kept saying, as they forced him to his knees. 100 times, my lord. We all had her. When Sir Illyn presented Pia with his head, she had smiled through her ruined teeth. Derry had changed hands several times during the fighting, and its castle had been burned once and sacked at least twice, but Lancel had seemingly wasted little time setting things to rights. The castle gates were newly hung, raw oaken planks reinforced with iron studs. A new stable was going up where an older one had been put to the torch. The steps to the keep had been replaced, and the shutters on many of the windows. Blackened stones showed where the flames had licked, but time and rain would fade those. Within the walls, crossbowmen walked the ramparts, some in crimson cloaks and lion-crested helms, others in the blue and grey of House Frey. As Jamie trotted across the yard, chickens ran out from under Honor's hooves, sheep bleated, and peasants stared at him with sullen eyes. Armed peasants, he did not fail to note. Some had scythes, some staves, some a hose sharpened to cruel points. There were axes in evidence as well, and he spied several bearded men with red seven-pointed stars sewn onto ragged, filthy tunics. More bloody sparrows. Where do they all come from? Of his uncle Kevin he saw no sign, nor of Lancel. Only a maester emerged to greet him with a grey robe flapping about his skinny legs. Lord Commander, Darry is honoured by this unexpected visit. You must forgive our lack of preparations. We had been given to understand that you were bound for River Run. Darry was on my way, lied Jamie. River Run will keep. And if perchance the siege had ended before he reached the castle, he would be spared the need to take up arms against House Tully. Dismounting, he handed honour to a stable boy. Will I find my uncle here? He did not supply a name. Sir Kevin was the only uncle he had left, the last surviving son of Tytus Lannister. No, my lord, Sir Kevin took his leave of us after the wedding. The maester pulled at the chain collar, as if it had grown too tight for him. I know Lord Lancel will be pleased to see you and all your gallant knights, though it pains me to confess that Darry cannot feed so many. We have our own provisions. You are Maester Ottermore, if it please my lord. Lady Amaray wished to welcome you herself, but she is seeing to the preparation of a feast in your honour. It is her hope that you and your chief knights and captains will join us at table this evening. A hot meal would be most welcome. The days have been cold and wet. Jamie glanced about the yard at the bearded faces of the sparrows. Too many, and too many frays as well. Where will I find Hardstone? We had a report of outlaws beyond the Trident. Sir Harwin took 5 knights and 20 archers and went to deal with them. And Lord Lancel? He is at his prayers. His lordship has commanded us never to disturb him when he is praying. He and Sir Bonifer should get on well. Very well. There would be time enough to talk with his cousin later. Show me to my chambers and have a bath brought up. If it please my lord, we have put you in the ploughman's keep. I will show you there. I know the way. Jamie was no stranger to this castle. He and Circe had been guests here twice before, once on their way to Winterfell with Robert, and again on the way back to King's Landing. Though small as castles went, it was larger than an inn with good hunting along the river. Robert Baratheon had never been loath to impose upon the hospitality of his subjects. The keep was much as he recalled it. The walls are still bare, Jamie observed as the maester led him down a gallery. Lord Lancel hopes one day to cover them with hangings, said Ottermore. Scenes of piety and devotion. Piety and devotion. It was all he could do not to laugh. The walls had been bare on his first visit, too. Tyrion had pointed out the squares of darker stone where tapestries had once hung. Sir Raymond could remove the hangings, but not the marks they'd left. Later, the imp had slipped a handful of stags to one of Darry's serving men for the key to the cellar where the missing tapestries were hidden. He showed them to Jaime by the light of a candle, grinning. Woven portraits of all the Targaryen kings, from the first Aegon to the second Ennis. If I tell Robert, mayhaps he'll make me Lord of Darry, the dwarf said, chortling. Maester Ottermore led Jamie to the top of the keep. I trust you will be comfortable here, my lord. There is a privy when nature calls. Your window looks out upon the godswood. The bedchamber adjoins her ladyship's, with a servant's cell between. These were Lord Darry's own apartments. Yes, my lord. My cousin is too kind. I did not intend to put Lancel out of his own bedchamber. Lord Lancel has been sleeping in the sept. Sleeping with the mother and the maiden when he has a warm wife just through that door? Jamie did not know whether to laugh or weep. Maybe he is praying for his cock to harden. In King's Landing it had been rumored that Lancel's wounds had left him incapable. Still, he ought to have sense enough to try. His cousin's hold on his new lands would not be secure until he fathered a son on his half-Darry wife. Jamie had begun to rue the impulse that had brought him here. He gave thanks to Ottermore, reminded him about the bath, and had Peck see him out. The lord's bedchamber had changed since his last visit, and not for the better. Old stale rushes covered the floor in place of the fine mirrorish carpet that had been there previously, and all the furnishings were new and crudely made. Sir Raymond Darry's bed had been large enough to sleep six, with brown velvet draperies and oakwood posts carved with vines and leaves. Lancel's was a lumpy straw pallet placed beneath the window where the first light of day would be sure to wake him. The other bed had no doubt been burned or smashed or stolen, but even so. When the tub arrived, little Lou pulled off Jamie's boots and helped remove his golden hand. Peck and Garrett hauled water, and Pia found him something clean to sup in. The girl glanced at him shyly as she shook his doublet out. Jamie was uncomfortably aware of the curve of hip and breast beneath her rough-spun brown dress. He found himself remembering the things that Pia had whispered to him at Harrenhal, the night that Kyburn sent her to his bed. "Sometimes when I'm with some man," she'd said, "I close my eyes and pretend it's you on top of me." He was grateful when the bath was deep enough to conceal his arousal. As he lowered himself into the steaming water, he recalled another bath, the one he'd shared with Brian. He had been feverish and weak from loss of blood, and the heat had made him so dizzy he found himself saying things better left unsaid. This time he had no such excuse. "Remember your vows. Pia is more fit for Tyrion's bed than yours. Fetch me soap and a stiff brush," he told Peck. "Pia, you may leave us."
"Aye, my lord. Thank you, my lord."
She covered her mouth when she spoke to hide her broken teeth. "Do you want her?" Jamie asked Peck when she was gone. The squire turned beet red. "If she'll have you, take her. She'll teach you a few things you'll find useful on your wedding night, I don't doubt. And you're not like to get a bastard by her." Pia had spread her legs for half his father's army and never quickened. Most like, the girl was barren. "If you bed her, though, be kind to her."
"Kind, my lord? How would I—"
"Sweet words. Gentle touches. You don't want to wed her, but so long as you're abed, treat her as you would your bride." The lad nodded.
"My lord, where should I take her? There's never a place to
be alone." Jamie grinned. "We'll be at supper several hours. The straw looks lumpy, but it should serve." Peck's eyes grew wide.
"His lordship's bed?
You'll feel a lord yourself when you're done, if Pia knows her business. And someone ought to make some use of that miserable straw mattress." When he descended for the feast that night, Jamie Lannister wore a doublet of red velvet slashed with cloth of gold, and a golden chain studded with black diamonds. He had strapped on his golden hand as well, polished to a fine bright sheen. This was no fit place to wear his whites. His duty awaited him at Riverrun. A darker need had brought him here. Darry's great hall was great only by courtesy. Trestle tables crowded it from wall to wall, and the ceiling rafters were black with smoke. Jamie had been seated on the dais to the right of Lancel's empty chair.
"Will my cousin not be joining us for supper?" he asked as he sat down. "My lord prefers to fast," said Lancel's wife, the Lady Amere. "He's sick with grief for the poor High Septon."
She was a long-legged, full-breasted, strapping girl of some 8 and 10 years, a healthy wench to look at her, though her pinched, chinless face reminded Jamie of his late and unlamented cousin Cleos, who had always looked somewhat like a weasel.
"Fasting? He is an even bigger fool than I suspected.
His cousin should be busy fathering a little weasel-faced heir on his widow, instead of starving himself to death." He wondered what Sir Kevin might have had to say about his son's new fervor. Could that be the reason for his uncle's abrupt departure? Over bowls of bean and bacon soup, Lady Amory told Jamie how her first husband had been slain by Sir Gregor Clegane when the Freys were still fighting for Robb Stark.
"I begged him not to go, but my pate was oh so very brave, and swore he was the man to slay that monster. He wanted to make a great name for himself."
"We all do.
When I was a squire, I told myself I'd be the man to slay the Smiling Knight. The Smiling Knight? She sounded lost. Who was that? The mountain of my boyhood, half as big but twice as mad. An outlaw, long dead. No one who need concern your ladyship. Amaray's lip trembled. Tears rolled from her brown eyes. You must forgive my daughter, said an older woman. Lady Amaray had brought a score of Freys to Derry with her, a sister, an uncle, a half-uncle, various cousins, and her mother, who had been born a Derry. She still grieves for her father. Outlaws killed him, sobbed Lady Amaray. Father had only gone out to ransom Peter Pimple. He brought them the gold they asked for, but they hung him anyway. Hanged, Army? Your father was not a tapestry. Lady Maria turned back to Jamie. I believe you knew him, sir. We were squires together once at Crake Hall. He would not go so far as to claim they had been friends. When Jamie had arrived, Merritt Frey had been the castle bully, lording it over all the younger boys. Then he tried to bully me. He was very strong. It was the only praise that came to mind. Merritt had been slow and clumsy and stupid, but he was strong. You fought against the Kingswood Brotherhood together, sniffed Lady Amaray. Father used to tell me stories. Father used to boast and lie, you mean. We did. Frey's chief contributions to the fight had consisted of contracting the pox from a camp follower and getting himself captured by the White Fawn. The outlaw queen burned her sigil into his arse before ransoming him back to Sumner Crakehall. Merritt had not been able to sit down for a fortnight, though Jamie doubted that the red-hot iron was half so nasty as the kettles of shit his fellow squires made him eat once he was returned. Boys are the cruelest creatures on the earth. He slipped his golden hand around his wine cup and raised it up. To Merritt's memory, he said, it was easier to drink to the man than to talk of him. After the toast, Lady Amaray stopped weeping and the table talk turned to wolves of the four-footed kind. Sir Danwell Frey claimed there were more of them about than even his grandfather could remember. They've lost all fear of men. Packs of them attacked our baggage train on our way down from the Twins. Our archers had to feather a dozen before the others fled. Sir Adam Marbrand confessed that their own column had faced similar troubles on their way up from King's Landing. Jamie concentrated on the fare before him, tearing off chunks of bread with his left hand and fumbling at his wine cup with his right. He watched Adam Marbrand charm the girl beside him, watched Stephen Swift refight the battle for King's Landing with bread and nuts and carrots. Sir Kenneth pulled the serving girl into his lap, urging her to stroke his horn, whilst Sir Dermot regaled some squires with tales of knight-errantry in the rainwood. Farther down the table, Hugo Vance had closed his eyes. Brooding on the mysteries of life, thought Jamie. That or napping between courses? He turned back to Lady Maria. The outlaws who killed your husband. Was it Lord Berwick's band? So we thought at first. Though Lady Maria's hair was streaked with grey, she was still a handsome woman. The killers scattered when they left Old Stones. Lord Viperon tracked one band to Fairmarket, but lost them there. Black Walder led hounds and hunters into Hag's Mire after the others. The peasants denied seeing them, but when questioned sharply, they sang a different song. They spoke of a one-eyed man and another who wore a yellow cloak, and a woman, cloaked and hooded. A woman? He would have thought that the White Fawn would have taught Merritt to stay clear of outlaw wenches. There was a woman in the Kingswood Brotherhood as well. I know of her. How not, her tone suggested, when she left her mark upon my husband. The White Fawn was young and fair, they say. This hooded woman is neither. The peasants would have us believe that her face was torn and scarred, and her eyes terrible to look upon. They claim she led the outlaws. Led them? Jamie found that hard to believe. Berwick Dondarrion and the Red Priest were not seen. Lady Maria sounded certain.
Dundarian's dead, said Strongbow. The mountain drove a knife through his eye. We have men with us who saw it.
That's one tale, said Adam Marbrand. Others will tell you that Lord Beric can't be killed.
Sir Harwin says those tales are lies.
Lady Amaray wound a braid around her finger.
He has promised me Lord Beric's head. He's very gallant.
She was blushing beneath her tears. Jamie thought back on the head he'd given to Pierre. He could almost hear his little brother chuckle. Whatever became of giving women flowers? Tyrion might have asked. He would have had a few choice words for Harwin Plum as well, though gallant would not have been one of them. Plum's brothers were big, fleshy fellows with thick necks and red faces, loud and lusty, quick to laugh, quick to anger, quick to forgive. Harwin was a different sort of Plum, hard-eyed and taciturn, unforgiving, and deadly with his hammer in his hand. A good man to command a garrison, but not a man to love. Although, Jamie gazed at Lady Amaray. The serving men were bringing out the fish course, a river pike baked in a crust of herbs and crushed nuts. Lancel's lady tasted it, approved, and commanded that the first portion be served to Jamie. As they set the fish before him, she leaned across her husband's place to touch his golden hand.
You could kill Lord Beric, Sir Jamie. You slew the Smiley Knight. Please, my lord, I beg you, stay and help us with Lord Beric and the hound.
Her pale fingers caressed his golden ones. Does she think that I can feel that? The Sword of the Morning slew the Smiling Knight, my lady. Sir Arthur Dane, a better knight than me. Jamie pulled back his golden fingers and turned once more to Lady Maria. How far did Black Walder track this hooded woman and her men?
His hounds picked up their scent again north of Hag's Mire, the older woman told him. He swears that he was no more than half a day behind them when they vanished into the neck.
Let them rot there, declared Sir Kenneth cheerfully. If the gods are good, they'll be swallowed up in quicksand or gobbled down by lizard lions.
Or taken in by frog-eaters, said Sir Danwell Frey. I would not put it past the Crannog men to shelter outlaws.
Would that it were only them, said Lady Maria. Some of the river lords are hand in glove with Lord Beric's men as well.
The small folk, too, sniffed her daughter. Sir Harwin says they hide them and feed them, and when he asks where they've gone, they lie. They lie to their own lords.
Have their tongues out, urged Strongbow.
Good luck getting answers then, said Jamie. If you want their help, you need to make them love you. That was how Arthur Dane did it when we rode against the Kingswood Brotherhood. He paid the small folk for the food we ate, brought their grievances to King Ares, expanded the grazing lands around their villages, even won them the right to fell a certain number of trees each year and take a few of the king's deer during the autumn. The forest folk had looked to Toyne to defend them, but Sir Arthur did more for them than the Brotherhood could ever hope to do and won them to our side. After that, the rest was easy.
The Lord Commander speaks wisely, said Lady Maria. We shall never be rid of these outlaws until the small folk come to love Lancel as much as they once loved my father and grandfather.
Jamie glanced at his cousin's empty place. Lancel will never win their love by praying, though.
Lady Amaray put on a pout. Sir Jamie, I pray you, do not abandon us. My lord has need of you, and so do I. These are such fearful times. Some nights I can hardly sleep for fear.
My place is with the king, my lady.
I'll come, offered Strongbow. Once we're done at Riverrun, I'll be itching for another fight. Not that Beric Dondarrion is like to give me one. I recall the man from Tourney's past, a comely lad in a pretty cloak he was, slight and callow.
That was before he died, said young Sir Arwood Frey. Death changed him, the small folk say. You can kill him, but he won't stay dead. How do you fight a man like that? And there's the hound as well. He slew 20 men at Saltpans.
Strongbow guffawed. 20 fat innkeeps, maybe. 20 serving men pissing in their breeches. 20 begging brothers armed with bowls. Not 20 knights. Not me.
There is a knight at Saltpans, Sir Arwood insisted. He hid behind his walls, whilst Clegane and his mad dogs ravaged through his town. You have not seen the things he did, sir. I have. When the reports reached the twins, I rode down with Harry's Hay and his brother Donal and 50 men, archers and men-at-arms. We thought it was Lord Berwick's work and hoped to find his trail. All that remains of Saltpans is the castle, and old Sir Quincy so frightened he would not open his gates, but shouted down at us from his battlements. The rest is bones and ashes. A whole town. The hound put the buildings to the torch, and the people to the sword, and rode off laughing. The women. You would not believe what he did to some of the women. I will not speak of it at table. It made me sick to see. I cried when I heard, said Lady Amory. Jamie sipped his wine. What makes you certain it was the hound? What they were describing sounded more like Gregor's work than Sandor's. Sandor had been hard and brutal, yes, but it was his big brother who was the real monster in House Clegane. He was seen, Sir Arwood said. That helm of his is not easily mistaken nor forgotten, and there were a few who survived to tell the tale. The girl he raped, some boys who hid, a woman we found trapped beneath a blackened beam, the fisherfolk who watched the butchery from their boats. Do not call it butchery, Lady Maria said softly. That gives insult to honest butchers everywhere. Saltpans was the work of some fell beast in human skin. This is a time for beasts, Jamie reflected, for lions and wolves and angry dogs, for ravens and carrion crows. Evil work, Strongbow filled his cup again. Lady Maria, Lady Amory, your distress has moved me. You have my word. Once River Run has fallen, I shall return to hunt down the hound and kill him for you. Dogs do not frighten me. This one should. Both men were large and powerful, but Sandor Clegane was much quicker and fought with a savagery that Lyle Crakehall could not hope to match. Lady Amory was thrilled, however. You are a true knight, Sir Lyle, to help a lady in distress. At least she did not call herself a maiden. Jamie reached for his cup and knocked it over. The linen tablecloth drank the wine. As the red stain spread, his companions all pretended not to notice. High table courtesy, he told himself, but it tasted just like pity. He rose abruptly. My lady, pray excuse me. Lady Amory looked stricken. Would you leave us? There's venison to come, and capon stuffed with leeks and mushrooms. Very fine, no doubt, but I could not eat another bite. I need to see my cousin. Bowing, Jamie left them to their food. Men were eating in the yard as well. The sparrows had gathered round a dozen cook fires to warm their hands against the chill of dusk and watch fat sausages spit and sizzle above the flames. There had to be 100 of them. Useless mouths. Jamie wondered how many sausages his cousin had laid by and how he intended to feed the sparrows once they were gone. They will be eating rats by winter unless they can get a harvest in. This late in autumn, the chances of another harvest were not good. He found the sept off the castle's inner ward, a windowless, seven-sided, half-timbered building with carved wood doors and a tiled roof. Three sparrows sat upon its steps. When Jamie approached, they rose. "Where are you going, my lord?" asked one. He was the smallest of the three, but he had the biggest beard. "Inside. His lordship's in there praying. His lordship is my cousin." "Well then, my lord," said a different sparrow, a huge bald man with a seven-pointed star painted over one eye. "You won't want to bother your cousin at his prayers."
"Lord Lancel is asking the Father above for guidance," said the third sparrow, the beardless one. A boy, Jamie had thought, but her voice marked her for a woman dressed in shapeless rags and a shirt of rusted mail. "He is praying for the soul of the High Septon and all the others who have died."
"They'll still be dead tomorrow," Jamie told her. "The Father above has more time than I do. Do you know who I am?"
"Some lord," said the big man with the starry eye.
"Some cripple," said the small one with the big beard.
"The Kingslayer," said the woman. But we're no kings, just poor fellows, and you can't go in unless his lordship says you can. She hefted a spiked club, and the small man raised an axe. The doors behind them opened. Let my cousin pass in peace, friend.